Hey friends, it's Melvin. Thanks for tuning into this episode. Here's just a few quick things I wanted to notify you guys about before we get started. First up, very soon, new episodes will be releasing Wednesday mornings rather than Tuesday. So don't panic if you don't see a new episode on Tuesday. Just wait a little longer and you'll see it in your feed. Second, we've introduced a mailbag. Check those show notes and toward the bottom you'll see a mailbag link. You'll then be able to text us any questions you might have about movies, the movie industry, or any movie/Christian related questions you might have. Then we'll respond in a future episode, so send us your questions now. Up next, Patreon polls, which are available to Patreon supporters at the $3 tier or higher, have been updated. Supporters can now suggest films or shows to be reviewed at the end of each month. The two most liked submissions will become the options for the Patreon poll, so if you want to hear us talk about your favorite movie or show, join our Patreon and start campaigning. And lastly, whether you're a new or longtime listener, please consider writing a review or rating the Cinematic Doctrine podcast on iTunes and Spotify. Apart from financially supporting on Patreon, these are the two most helpful ways to support the show. And that's it. Enjoy the episode. You're listening to Cinematic Doctrine. Hey guys, if you just press play, you are missing out on 42 minutes of content that is exclusive to Patreon supporters. This content is essentially just, how do I describe? It is a bit of a silly, fun, theme park-based role play in which each of us, there's two people with me here, so the three of us, one of us proposes a theme park ride, one of us proposes why that is a success, and then the other one proposes why it might be dangerous, a failure, or it has risk involved. We have a lot of fun being creative, and we all make it Dune-themed, because it's kind of fun to imagine, like, as things become stupendously popular, what would a theme park of that look like? And so we have a lot of fun doing that. I sprung this on my two guests as a surprise, so it was all just improvised, something we just kind of came up with, had a lot of fun with it. Support on Patreon for $3 a month to get access to that. We go through six different rides and have a good time. Supporting on Patreon gets you a lot of other good stuff for all these other episodes over the last, 2.5 years of content. All at the beginning of each episode that's available on Patreon, so it's immediately accessible once you press play. But you'll hear about a bunch of other perks and benefits to supporting on Patreon. As you're listening to this episode of Dune 2, we're going to be doing a movie discussion on Dune 2. We do, in fact, have an episode on Denis Villeneuve's previous Dune film that came out a couple years ago. So if you want to hear about that, you can go back. But if you've already heard it, or you just want to hear us talk about Dune 2, then that's what we're here for. The movie discussions are going to be general, topical discussion. The first half roughly is no spoilers, but we'll still go into themes. Second half specifically will be into spoilers. We kind of just transition to that as we feel is appropriate. So at some point I'll make that more clear. For this episode, though, I do have a guest. We have Jerry Dugan back on the podcast. He was on our episode for Avatar, and now he's on our episode for Dune. What's going on?
Hey, I'm excited. This is so cool, and I had fun geeking out and thinking of a theme park themed to Dune, and I think I'm going to be thinking about that long after we finish recording this.
And all we need to know is if any of our ideas come true, we have evidence to prove. And all we have to say is somebody at Disney or somebody at Universal heard our episode. And if that's true, we're making a lot of money, guys.
Man.
Oh, man. But
I'll be watching for Broadway attractions for sure.
Oh, there you go. And then also joining us, we'll hear more about Jerry in a second, but also joining us is Cheryl. I wanted to make sure that people know Cheryl is here.
Hi, Cheryl. Again. Hello. Hi, everybody again. It's such a joy to be here. I may or may not have forced my way onto this podcast because I just really love Dune and I really wanted to talk about it.
That's so okay. 2 years ago, I was like, Jerry, if there's any other stuff you want to be on, let me know. And he just goes, Dune 2. I want to be on Dune 2. And I said,
so he okay, got let's to it. Do it. He got to it before me because I said the same thing, but after.
Yeah, we were still recording the other episode on Avatar 2.
I think that's true. I think that it was literally in that. We were like, yeah, let's
there
do
you
it.
Go.
But since then, Jerry has still been doing Beyond the Rut podcast. We can hear more about that too. But also since then, has published a book, which is pretty cool, also based on the podcast. You want to talk about the tell us about the podcast, how that's been going, and then also about your freaking book, because that's just objectively really cool.
Yeah. So the podcast, I started with two other friends of mine. The idea was that we wanted to encourage men who are 35 to 45 years old just to have success in their faith, their family, their fitness levels, finances, and just become the future person they wanted to become, and in aligning that in a very spiritual sort of way. So 5 years later, the other two hosts have left the show, and it's just me, and I'm going through the original like goals that we had for the show, and writing a book, the manifesto of the show was one of those, and my friends challenged me to get that book done. So yeah, March of 2023, I published Beyond the Rut, Create a Life Worth Living in Your Faith, Family, and Career. And it shares some of the stories from over 300 interviews that I have done on that show since 2015. And in writing that book, realized there's like this framework of, if I feel like I'm stuck in a rut, what do I do to get out of that? And so the book takes you through those three phases to recognize the rut you're in, understand where you really want to go and what success looks like, and then how to take action to get there. And it gives some very practical tips on how to do each of those three stages.
I specifically like that you not just have a demographic, but you're able to gun for it. Because I think as someone who has repeatedly on this podcast lately been talking about, like, I'm making this a joke, but, oh, I'm 28, I'm getting old. But like this idea of feeling like getting to everything too late. I mean, I went to inpatient, which then is almost like you have this idea that can infect your mind where it's like, I've wasted my life and I'm only finally getting it together. And then you're saying your show is specifically like men 35 to 45. I'm not even there yet. And you're still finding a way to motivate and finding a way to like encourage older, or not old, older than me, but midlife men to still take action. I just find that really cool. Have you found that to be not just transformative in your own life, but like stupendously effective for other men who are like maybe, well, in a rut, so to speak?
The most surprising thing is, you know, we were very specific about who our audience is that we're targeting, and we even described them in an avatar we named AJ. So AJ was 38, married to his college sweetheart, two kids, one in elementary school, one in middle school, has a nice six-figure income with a leadership role. Like, I know AJ's life inside and out, probably because I based it off a real friend of mine. but the thing that has surprised me the most is that when I look at the demographics from who visits the website and who responds to each episode that comes out, it is a wide swath of folks. So it is 50-50 men and women who listen to the show and have purchased the book. The age range, I think, is as young as 17 or 18 years old on up to 64.
That's cool.
And the biggest demographic has been the 20s, 30s, and then it jumps to like the 50s. And I'm like, wow, what happened to my demographic? That was
so exactly the opposite of your demographic. Yeah. It's amazing.
and it's, I think a lot of people being proactive, they're like, oh, I don't want to be like that person who's living in regret. What can I do now? And so the interviews on the show, the book, seem to really resonate with the folks who want to be proactive and not have a life of regret when they get to their 50s and 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. And then the folks in their 50s are like, you know what? It's not too late. I'm still alive. Yes. And maybe I could fix some things, or maybe I could pass on some later learned wisdom to my kids and grandkids. So that seems to be the motivator for the folks who are in their 50s and 60s, is what could I pass on to my kids that I wish I had when I was their age? So that's pretty neat to see.
Something cool that this is just reminding me of, and maybe, I don't know, Cheryl, it'd be interesting to hear what you think of this too. But like our mom went back to school at like late 40s, early 50s, and then just got her master's. And like, she was just like, first off, this was the easiest time I had at education, because she's like, both my kids are gone and they moved out and like, I have a lot of time to kill. And so like, but then she was talking about how like, it was just this awesome experience to be able to do something and have like a career accomplishment or career goal met at a time when you're growing up, you sort of see as a later year. Yeah. And I thought that was so motivational and cool to hear. Oh, I don't know if you felt that way too, Cheryl. But
I was so inspired. I mean, she inspired me to end up getting my own master's. So I think for a time, we actually were getting our master's together.
Oh, wow.
Not at the same school.
different career path, all that kind of stuff. But I think we kind of did it at the same time. So I just thought it was really neat. And it, I think, and I know men experience this too, but I think especially for women, there's a lot of like, what am I supposed to do with my life? I must figure it out now. And it's either become a wife and then a stay-at-home mom, or have a career and not have the other. And it's, it can be very difficult with all of that. I'm in my young 30s and I still don't really know what I want to do with my life. I love the job that I have. I love the career that I chose and the master's I have and all that kind of stuff. But I'm like, I still don't know what I want to do. But hey, my mom was in her 50s when she got her master's, and she's in a really fun career and she really loves it. So I have hope.
Yeah, not even to be specific to her career, but like it's something that she wasn't doing that when we were growing up. So it's like it's a literal next chapter. So it's neat to hear that your show, Jerry, like simultaneously hits on like people younger than us who are in the midst of beginning their, maybe that's it. They're hitting chapters in their life and then they're moving into the next one. That's just really cool. Any particular episodes you recommend people check out between Avatar and now, or really just whenever, but since we last had you on?
Oh man. I like them all.
I know. I threw that on you. Just yeah. Like, yeah.
And it's not so. Because I mean, because it is a guest-based show mostly. So it's the guest that makes me like them the most. In fact, the one that's popping into my head right now, I just shared with a friend of mine who reached out and said, hey, I'm curious about some episodes you may have done that talk about the value of diversity and equity and inclusion. I know that's not what your show's about. But maybe you've done one where that's come up somehow. And I was like, you know what? Actually, I talked with a former executive of the Walt Disney Company, Lee Cockerell. And what we talked about was his idea of the three E's, that if you want to grow in your career, or if you want to be the kind of leader who helps other people grow in their careers, you got to get as much of the three E's as possible. And the three E's were exposure to things outside your comfort zone. And that's other cultures, mm-hmm. other ideas, other just anything other than you. Get exposed to that.
Yeah.
Education was the other one. So get training, read books, listen to podcasts, you know, watch documentaries, go to lectures, and gain experience. So where your coworkers might be saying, well, that's not my job, I'm not going to do it, you can also look at that same situation and say, is this something that's going to help me gain an experience I can put on my resume? And when a management position opens up, or another position opens up in another department, I could say with a fact, yes, I can do that. In fact, remember this project over here? I was the guy who led that, or I was the mm-hmm. guy who played a part in that. And so the three E's. And I was able to share that with my friend. And I was like, yeah, that was pretty cool. Because when Lee talked about exposure specifically, he was focused on cultures other than his own. He's from a small town, Ardmore, Oklahoma. It is a small town, like 20,000-30,000 people. He said everybody looked like him. And then he leaves Ardmore for the military, and a lot of people don't look like him. So now he's got friends named Juan and Mohammed and Ichiro. And he's like, I did not have that in Ardmore. So when I got exposed to other cultures, it really broadened my horizon about what's possible, that there's more than one way to do a thing. And he said that alone allowed him to be the guy who opened up Disneyland Paris. So he was that guy. He is the guy, before he retired, he was in charge of the Walt Disney World Resort. So all the resorts, those executives reported to him. And his son was running Magic Kingdom for a little bit. So
that's so cool.
It's probably my favorite episode. Probably one of my favorite guests. Sorry, Scott, if you're listening. Love you, man.
Hey, don't forget, there's a lot of fun content missing from this episode because you're not listening on Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/cinematicdoctrine and support for $3 a month to gain access to uncut episodes with upwards of 40 minutes of bonus content each. You'll thank me later. As we now transition into talking about Dune Part 2, I'll go ahead and give us a quick description on this film so that we can get into just talking about it. As people listen and hear us talk about it, if you get bored of our episode, you can always go listen to Jerry's. There's going to be a link in the show notes down below, and I'll probably get the link from you for that particular episode, so we can have it down there too. Dune Part 2. This is going to be our follow up to the Dune episode we did a couple years ago. Basically starts immediately after the first film, so I think for our first half of the discussion where we don't talk about spoilers for Dune 2. We will obviously talk about spoilers from Dune 1. Dune 1 ends with Paul on the run. The Atreides house has fallen almost entirely. All that's left is probably a very limited amount, but House Atreides has fallen. Paul is on the run. The Harkonnens are chasing them down. They are by the Bene Gesserit are not allowed to kill Paul, but they are not necessarily going to try and let him live. And as the story continues, we essentially see as Paul begins to fall into what is a prophecy of a savior that is going to save the Fremen, bring them into paradise. And Paul, who believes he may or may not be that person, but recognizes people see him as that way. Paul, essentially through this film, we see how he works through that cultural image, and we get to watch what he takes advantage of, what he maybe rejects, what he enjoys personally through the Fremen. We know from the previous film that he respects and honors his father, and his father, Leto, respected the Fremen. And so but he wants to be his own person. And as his father so graciously says, and will probably most definitely follow up into the third film, that no matter what he chooses, he will always be Leto's son. Paul is now continuing to work that out. Meanwhile, his mother, who is she is Bene Gesserit, but it seems to also operate on her own will, is continuing to stoke the flames of prophecy and faith in the Fremen. And then a bunch of other characters do a bunch of other things because this movie's massive. Harkonnens have infighting and there's all this other crazy stuff and the story continues. People are considering this. Before the movie even came out, I forgot which director said it, but one of them was like, this is going to be Villeneuve's Empire Strikes Back, which of course lends people to thinking, is it going to be a tragic ending? Is it going to be just an epic film? Is it just going to be a perfect film? I guess that's why you press play to hear us talk about it, to figure this out. To get us started, Jerry, what did you think of Dune Part 2?
I loved it.
Yeah.
Period. Or exclamation point. One of those.
did you catch what format of did you see this movie in? IMAX, Dolby, standard?
Standard laser? I didn't know that was a thing, but okay. Standard, but they said the action would pop a bit more, and I'm like, yeah, okay.
Probably brighter colors.
Yeah.
Solid colors.
Or something like that.
What was it about this movie that you particularly loved about it?
Oh man. Similar to what I loved about the first one, where the visuals, the way it was shot, the angles, the sound effects, the color, all really took me back to being in a desert. You know, I was in the Army, I was in Operation Iraqi Freedom, and in watching both parts one and part two, I could feel the sand behind my ears. Like I was joking on the Patreon special that we should make this so realistic that you're digging sand out of your tear ducts for weeks. That was me when I came home from Iraq. It's such a fine mist of dust that it gets into everything. And I was cleaning it for weeks. And I felt that grittiness watching that movie. I could smell the desert smells, even though there's no smells in the movie. And even when they're in the slot canyon type of structures and I could feel the coolness. Like it's just the way the shadows were, I felt like, it's not so hot in here, but it was all in my head based on what I was seeing and hearing in the film. And that, just from the visual perspective, because if I say any more, I'm going to get into spoilers and we're not ready for that.
In comparison to the first one then, what do you think this movie innovates on? Cause I know one of the consistent criticisms of the first one was that the film just felt odd. It felt like 1.5 movies. And so like, do you feel like this one feels much more structured, more focused, more of a movie?
I think when you stitch the two together, you get one really big movie. That's for sure. Or like, like with a Netflix series where you have 10 parts, this is a continuation of, and that was something that was very impressive to me, was that there was no time jump. It just, boom, we were like in probably days after how the first movie ended. And I thought, wow, that's pretty impressive how they pulled that off. And to make the adaptations they had to make to the original, like the source material, they still to me, pulled off the essence of the story and the characters themselves. Like Fade Rautha. I was scared of that dude. Yes.
So good.
Yes.
Like, it's so good.
The Sting version, it's like, okay, that works for the 80s, but I was never scared of Fade played by Sting. I was scared of Austin Butler. Like, I will probably never watch Elvis the same again. Like,
yeah.
Oh, that's right. Yes. I forgot. I never watched Elvis, but I forgot. Oh, what two different people.
Same guy. Oh, and this says so much about the range of the acting capability. And even Timothy Chalamet, like, my wife and I just watched Wonka the other night. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this dude can sing? Like, I know he can rap on SNL, but he can sing? And, oh, man. Yeah.
Yeah. I had right before seeing two in theaters, I was like, I got the Blu-ray. I'll watch the first one again. So I put it on. Great still. Keeps getting better each time I watched it, because the first time I watched it, I thought, this is a good movie, but might not be my favorite of Villeneuve. And then as I continued watching, I was like, still not my favorite of Villeneuve, but much better than the first time, because I knew more what to expect. But then, finished the movie, had about an hour downtime, went to see the second one in theaters, and immediately, almost the exact same frame composition, colors, feeling, vibe, aesthetic, everything was all... It was like they were basically like, they're walking at the end of the movie. Chani's like, this is only the beginning. And then like, oh, we have to hide. The Harkonnens are about to find us. Like, it was that quick, which was just really impressive, that pickup. But before I share more, Cheryl, what did you think of Dune 2? What did you think? Because you weren't on the first episode. What did you think of one? And then what do you think of two?
Oh, goodness. So top favorite. Five favorite movies, probably. Honestly, if I really...
The first one?
I'm just trying to decide, is it just my favorite movie? if I'm not counting my absolute love and adoration for, like, Lion King and Beauty and the Beast, animated Disney versions, not the live actions, that's a whole separate category. I honestly do think both Dune 1 and 2, because for me, I definitely see them as one movie. Because okay, let me answer your question first. Loved it. Every second. Favorite.
Yeah.
Like, I'll die on a hill kind of thing. Like, just...
Very, very
so
good.
So good. And I didn't finish... I didn't finish the book before watching the first one. And they split it in a different way between the parts of the book. Like, part one of the book extends a little bit into what they do with the movie, I think. And then part two happens and it's the time jump, which they don't do. By the time I saw the second part, I had finished the book 6 months ago, maybe. Mm-hmm. So 3 years later, I finally finished the book.
Mm-hmm.
I loved everything they did with it, with one exception, although I'm warming up to it. But we walked out of that theater and we don't have a fancy movie theater here. It's like a little like mom and pop owned movie theater down
that's
the road.
Cute though.
Two or three rows of like the fancy seats where you like recline back and get cozy and it's great. So it wasn't like
an intimate
IMAX
theater
or whatever.
Though. It's an intimate
It was
theater.
Nice.
Yeah.
I found myself sitting there tense, holding my breath. I loved it. We left the theater and I was like, that's it.
Gotta
that
see
right
it again.
There is fantastic. And I'll never get sick of watching them. And what I don't think I had any type of expectations for part two, because I knew it technically wasn't a sequel. However, being part two or the next part of the movie, I was a little worried that it would have like the sequel issue of not being as good as the first one. But since it's just the story split.
Yeah, I get you.
It worked.
Like how people talk about Lord of the Rings now. Like some people I've seen online just talk about Lord of the Rings as a unit, even though they are different movies.
Three separate movies, but 12 hours total, at least.
But like when you watch them, most of the time people will do them in a single sitting or if they have time. Or
very
have
quickly
them.
Right after each other. Yeah. It's one thing.
And they do feel like one film. But they also, they do feel also like a separate thing. Yeah, I liked this too. I like Dune Part 2. As I've said, I like Dune 1. By the time we had actually done our episode on the first one, and I didn't have time to re-listen to it to like maybe carry some themes over in discussion. But I do recall saying in that episode, like I saw it twice in theaters. The first time I thought it was good. The second time I thought it was great. I thought that like part of what made that first film so good is that like Villeneuve confidently carries you through some of the most like truly bizarre stuff you've seen in a movie, because it's a combination of science fiction and fantasy. It's like a world so advanced that they reject computer chips for probably some in-world reason that is in like the books, but then also don't use guns because like the shields are so effective at blocking, I guess, bullets that now we just resort back to swordplay. So like there's so many weird things in that first movie that get so like trusting of the audience that only a director like Denis Villeneuve can put it together, because he has so much confidence that the audience they'll understand. And if not, that's okay. They'll understand later. We had just released the episode on Arrival in the like last week. And like that movie entirely trusts the audience to just accept that it's not an alien invasion movie and you won't watch any gunfire, even though you hear it for like 1 second in the movie. And so with that in mind, going into Dune 2, I was like, all right, I trust that it's going to be a good movie. But also like Arrival, there was a bit of this, like, do I want to watch this movie? Like, am I going to have to do some work to feel it out? And then of course, just like with the first movie, you sit down and then you hear some throat singing and you go, oh, I'm in good hands. Like, cause that's just such a yeah. weird way to start a movie.
It
and
is.
Then in this movie it happens and I'm like, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's great, cause it's simultaneously a shock because it's like Sardaukar throat singing. And then it's also a poem, like it's a single mm-hmm. stanza poem to set up the theme of what the film's going to be. The first one being like dreams are what are they, like messages from the deep. So like this yearning, longing from within the heart. And what do you pine for? And then that's kind of what the movie is Paul figuring that out. And what's that going to mm-hmm. be, whether it's in the future or the past, what is it going to be as a unit himself? Which is a consistent theme of Villeneuve's filmography. Arrival's basically like, what are you going to do about your whole person and self across your whole life? Blade Runner is, who are you going to be? And like, does it matter who you like? It's so complicated in that way. Sicario, more of an action film, but very much about the value of human life and the pain of human suffering. It's very like, if humans didn't matter, Sicario wouldn't be such an evocative film, but humans do matter, so it makes it just a petrifying movie to watch. I mentioned that in the Arrival episode, but all that to say is Villeneuve does that, and then you get to Dune Part 2 and he continues with his exploration of these characters. But I think in this movie, unlike Dune 1, which to me felt more ethereal and more mm-hmm. about like the exploration of these ideas, because even Paul's character is more just a person that's existing through and hasn't made decisions until the ending, really. And that's the climax of the movie as I perceive it. This movie is now like, all right, we have those ideas. Let's just make a good movie. And so to me, I felt like stepping out of the theater, I was like, that was just an awesome adventure movie. There were some awesome moments, way more action, action that is shot in ways that like are just haven't seen really much. Like with so much clarity and excitement. There's great characters and people who come back that are just exciting to see on screen again. Action that is, or violence that is visceral. The Harkonnens are so terrifying in this movie. I thought it was great too. It's like probably, apart from the fact that I've only seen two movies from this year, this and Madame Web. Obviously, this is not as good as Madame Web, but of course.
Obviously, I'd expect nothing less.
Oh man.
No, it's
oh, man.
Shocking the amount of confidence that's different between the two movies. Madame Web, completely decimated by the people who put that movie together. Probably yeah. because they thought Spider-Man was going to be contractually capable of being in it, and then learned late in production that they couldn't do that and had to just fix it. That's my presumption. And then this movie, where it's like from the start, they're like, we trust you, Villeneuve. And mm-hmm. they just, and then he just does it. And so hopefully we see that it's financially successful so far. It's, I think, the third weekend, second weekend. It seems that it is. But all that to say is, I thought this movie, total banger, really great. I want to see it again. I'm trying to see if I can make time for that. You may not know this, but the easiest way you can show your support for Cinematic Doctrine is to rate and review the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen. So press pause and share your thoughts. We'd love to hear what you have to say. And then press play again so you can hear the rest of the show. But moving forward, what did the movie bring out in you? So you see this movie, you're sitting down and you're watching it. The phrase I write for this section, what did the movie evoke in you? You step out of that theater. What does it have you thinking of? What is it drawn? This kind of can be either comparing with the previous film or maybe even comparing with the book. Jerry, what did the movie bring out in you?
That theme around not blindly following a charismatic leader. I think that that was one of those themes that, having read the book and then seeing it unfold right there, right up to the very end, I'm like, yeah, suckers. Cause people who've seen it, but didn't read the book first are like, wait, so what happened? So a lot of the TikTok, reactions I've seen, it's like, yeah. But if you read the book, you'd really see all the nuances in that. So, that was one thing that really made me think about, especially, when we watch the news today, it's like, oh, okay. Yeah. That's surprisingly a lot of parallels. And I saw a clip from, Frank Herbert when he was still alive, of course, because you can't really do interviews when you're not.
AI would like to have a conversation right? with you.
That's true. There's that. One of the references he had made was that, the theme is a lot of focus around, should we really just blindly trust government? And he even praises President Nixon. He's like, one of the things President Nixon reminded us was that we probably shouldn't blindly just trust a political figure or a government. And I'm like, wow. So there was a lot of that. And the culture part of it, because this is a world that exists 20,000 years in the future of where we are right now. So you guys are listening to now, bringing back the Spaceballs references, guys. People are like, what's he talking about?
No, that's then.
What happened to then? You missed it. When? Just now. So the things that we see, like the Sardaukar doing the throat singing, it's almost like a nod to the Mongolians and that warrior society. The Fremen and their nods to Arabic cultures. The Bene Gesserit kind of have a lot of nods to, I think, Orthodox Christianity, if I remember correctly.
Could be, yeah.
Yeah, they got the orange Catholic Bible. I always wonder if it literally was orange, because, we don't see it in the book, because we get quotes, but we don't see it. What does it really look like? And so I love all those nods, even the bagpipes, when they come off the ships and stuff, from the first movie. And it's like, it sounds Scottish, but it sounds so dissonant at the same time. It's like, well, that's what happens to bagpipe music in 20,000 years. It's it's evolved, it's changed. So I love that humanity of it. There's a sense of familiarity with things that we could recognize, because even though it's that far in the future, these are influences from our time. And so I thought that was really cool.
Cheryl, what about you? What did when you were like watching the movie, what did it make you think about? What was on your mind? What did you have when you stepped out?
There were many moments where I was sitting in the comfiness of the chair that I was like, I was holding my breath. I was like fully invested into pretty much everything that was going on. When Paul's learning how to ride the worm, I'm just like, I'm freaking out for
freaking
him.
Scene.
And I'm just like,
yeah,
this is intense. And I
saw this in Dolby, and that scene was like amazing.
Oh, I bet that
it was
beautiful.
So good. Like,
I bet it was beautiful.
Just so good. Yeah, it sounded great and everything, but go ahead. Sorry.
I think what I liked most and what I felt was it really felt like a love letter from Villeneuve of Dune. That he read the book, he loved it, he understood what Herbert was trying to do, telling the story of essentially a reluctant Messiah who didn't ask to be Messiah, who's being forced to be it because I would just want him to be. Like, he's just kind of like, it's right at the beginning of the movie, essentially. But like the Bene Gesserit are like, well, we failed with this, let's make a new one. And like, they're hoping that whoever the child is that is going to be made is going to be the, I'm not going to say
I forget the term.
Kwisatz Haderach.
one. And it's just like, they're just trying to make this thing. And I don't want to say spoiler alert now. Because
Well, they're trying to create their own savior primarily exactly. that can be controlled because they want to like pigeonhole them into something that they can like empower or something.
Which is interesting because in doing that, that's exactly what Paul becomes. Like he becomes exactly what they wanted, except they can't control him. It's like a weird, crazy, self-fulfilling prophecy that just doesn't end up being, I don't know. I just think he was a genius at like doing that. Like it's very confusing. It's very weird. And like Chalamet does amazing showing the confliction of it. Like he doesn't want to do this, but he doesn't feel like he has a choice because his mother is pushing him this way. The Fremen are pushing him this way. He just wants to do what's right. He does care for the Fremen and he wants to help them. But he doesn't want to do it at the expense of, and they don't use it in the movie, but a jihad. Like, he doesn't want everyone to die, but he doesn't feel like there's any way to do it. And I feel like Villeneuve really brought that into the entire movie. Like, the entire time I'm, like, feeling that struggle that Paul had to avoid that, and yet he just couldn't. Everything he did, he's like, I don't want to go to the South, because if I do, bad things are going to happen.
Yeah.
And it's like, I guess I have to know.
It's one of the major benefits of the movie actually being as long as it is, because it gives it that time to breathe. It gives mm-hmm. us that time to see our characters try other options or alternatives and like build up this nightmare. I think of one of the most simple examples of like why it's so important to build up in world importance is because then when it happens, it's exciting or fun or effective. And like the best example I can think of that's the most easy to explain that is John Wick. Like the first one, like you get some really good action sequences and some good filmography in the beginning, but they're constantly talking about like, oh, they killed his dog. No, who cares? We killed his dog. It's like, well, it was John Wick's dog. And everyone's like, oh, crap. Like, this is the worst thing we could have done. And like, they keep mentioning that. And then finally it happens. And you're like, oh, man, like, this guy's a monster. Like, this is going to be bad for them. And you just can't wait for it to happen. And so like, that like makes the movie more than just like Joe Schmo action adventure USA movie number 12, like 1200 mm-hmm. really, like another VHS tape of them. But like this movie, by being that, gives it a lot of time and patience. And I think like part of what made the first one difficult at times is it does feel like it's like the Cliff Notes extended version of a Cliff Notes one of my complaints was like, I wish there was more violence in the first movie. Cause like, you know, Beast Robot is cutting off people's heads, but it's behind fire. And I'm like, those are like seven people who died and I didn't even see it. Like, and it's like, I just needed you to give more, but you're giving me the Cliff Notes version of saying this guy is a bad dude. And then Dune 2, and like, you actually see the Harkonnens being wild, like crazy, mm-hmm. emotional, completely capitulating to their physical temptations kind of people. And like that to me makes the space more worthwhile. And then the addition of the first movie helps that as well, because they don't have to characterize as much when you have the first movie there to help it out.
Yeah, I did want to say, just to kind of point out, I think the point you're kind of making though too, I think Villeneuve did really well because the first part of the book is very much like the first part of the movie. It's like,
oh, is it?
Okay. Kind of chill, very slow, very expositional. Not a lot is going on. You see some of the like the craziness of the Harkonnens and all that kind of stuff, but it's very much like
just scenes.
Slow.
Yeah.
Like the movie. And then that second part, straight action. It's just fight after fight after fight. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you get a little bit of that. They talk about like a fight they did like off camera kind of thing, off stage.
Sure, sure.
But it's very much like as soon as part two starts in the book, everything just happens after that. And like Villeneuve did that fantastically. He like mm-hmm. really paid attention to the book in that way. And I think that's the way to do it.
Yeah.
I don't think he needed to fill in anything in the first movie to like get more action scenes in there and like add all to make it so people would be entertained and pull in. Like he's like, you know what? The book did it. It was successful. Let's just do it.
So then transitioning into spoilers, because I think that that'll just make this a lot more easier to talk about and ultimately give us a lot more to talk about. So if you haven't seen Dune 2, real quick around the table, do we recommend Dune 2? I say I recommend it. Jerry, yes. How about you?
Absolutely, yes.
and Cheryl?
100%.
Yeah, honestly, yes. This is like one of those movies where, like, when you see it, you'll remember why. Like, this is why you fall in love with movies. This is why you love fall in love with storytelling, with art. It is it is this. This is the Hollywood machine working to put it together. This is very classic Hollywood where all of the parts of the thing work together. So 100%, go see this movie if you haven't. It's going to be in theaters for a long time. And it'll probably be one of those movies where it keeps coming back, really. So, but we're going to be going into the spoiler discussion, having more open stuff. We're going to talk about like recurring themes, iconography, scenes, and the ending, of course. So if you haven't seen it, just go watch it. If you don't care what's wrong with you, but also keep listening because it's cool. Enjoying this episode? Grab that share link and tell your friends. Word of mouth is the most effective way for a podcast to reach new listeners, so don't be shy. Share the episode wherever you can. You know, Charlene was just talking about comparisons to the book, so I have not read it, but the two of you have. Jerry, how did the movie stack up with the book? Is there anything that was missing between the two movies? Because I think this movie ends where the first book ends, right? Like,
yes.
Okay, yeah. So, yep. How do both movies compare to the book, Jerry?
I think Denis Villeneuve really stayed true to the source content, like the source material. And so there were some plot changes that were big if you're going to be a traditionalist with the book. Like there's a time jump in the book where, you know, the book starts when Paul is 15 years old. It ends when he's probably closer to 19 or 20. He's a baby daddy. Can we say it that way? Yeah, because he wasn't married. So, yeah.
Yeah.
And
so there are these things that weren't included in the movie itself. And but you still see the evolution of Paul into this messiah type figure that they still pulled it off. That's the thing I'm really trying to say, is they really pulled it off. So there were some elements that had been removed, like Gurney Halleck in the book remains sort of like the grounding to remember who the Atreides are. That's kind of his role. Even in future books, hey, remember who the Atreides are. I follow the Atreides for these reasons. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the movie, he kind of goes down that dark path with Paul. Like, yeah, let's get our vengeance, man. Let's kill all the Harkonnens. Like,
there's also they took this out of the movie too, and I'm actually glad they did. He fully blames Jessica for what happened in the first movie.
Interesting.
He's like, okay, Jessica is the mole. It's not the doctor. It's Jessica. And the entire book until he meets up with Paul, fully believes it's Jessica. And by this point, she's drunk the water and they're just like, dude, no. And he's like going to try to kill her. And she's like, no. And then he like has a whole change of heart and everything.
It's like a subplot that just like,
yeah,
probably would have overcrowded the movie.
Yeah. I don't think it wouldn't have worked at all because they didn't introduce it at all in the first one, the first movie. So I was like, are they going to do it or not? And I'm glad they didn't. It's fine.
Because they didn't really touch on that at all in the first part of the movie either, because Baron Harkonnen says in the early part of the book, you know, we got plans within plans within plans. They reference that line a few times in the two movies, but the book really shows the plans within plans within plans. Like the Emperor wants the Emperor, who's got the Sardaukar, the best swords in the galaxy, is finally scared because for the first time ever, there is an army that is almost as good as the Sardaukar. Now, in his mind, that's the Atreides army, because Gurney Halleck and Duncan Idaho have raised this army that is much smaller. I had to Google, like, how big was the Atreides army? So in part one, the first movie, the Harkonnens and the Sardaukar combined are about 300,000 soldiers deep. Mm. The Atreides only have 10,000 soldiers on planet. So they're already outnumbered 30-1.
Wow.
Yeah. And so they didn't have a whole lot of chance, because on top of that, they had the element of surprise. They had firepower. Mm-hmm. The Harkonnens, you know, they're toting around laser guns in the opening of part two, which shows how much the Harkonnens really don't care because one of the nuances in the book is that when a laser gun hits one of those shields, so those shields protect you from knives and projectiles. So the style of fighting is very different to get through the shield. But the laser gun, you hit a shield with a laser gun, you create a nuclear blast. And if you're like, oh, well, shoot, we just shoot everybody with a shield with a nuclear or with a laser gun. But the problem is it creates a nuclear blast on both ends. The guy wearing the shield and the guy shooting the laser gun both create a nuclear blast.
Wow.
And
so that's not really in the movie, is it? They didn't really carry that over. I guess that would be really hard to explain, but that's really cool.
There
that's
weren't a, cool a lot detail. Of use of shields in the second
not
movie
as much.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting because there's like a whole thing about that in the first movie. And even in the first part of the book, I don't even think they use shields much in the second part of the book.
Yeah. Cause it attracts the sandworm.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's right.
Sandworms, too.
Exactly.
I forgot they mentioned that in the first
Which one. Is probably why the Fremen are the better fighter anyway.
Yeah.
They because they're not relying on the shield, and they can do everything else.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they end up being, and I don't know if you were going to get to this, Jerry, but the Fremen are the ones that the Emperor really should be scared of, because they are the ultimate fighter. It's their planet, their ancestry.
Like, well, it sounds like they don't even know how many Fremen are there in general.
Because they all think the southern part of the planet is just uninhabitable. And it's like no, that's what they want you to think. And like, I don't know why they're not using like their brains and reasoning to like
science.
Why is it uninhabitable? Guys, come on. Is it really?
I mean, isn't Jupiter covered in gas? It's probably uninhabitable. I'm not thinking this Fremen there, but I digress.
It's that, that nuance also from the book that doesn't get translated into the movie either, that the reason why the Empire, the Emperor, and the Harkonnens have no clue what's on the southern half of that planet is because the Guild, who pretty much own a monopoly on space travel as well as satellites, they technically could see what's on the planet. So the Guild knows. So for the Guild to not report to the Emperor or the Harkonnens or anybody what's on that southern part of the planet means they're receiving a sizable enough payment from somebody somewhere to just say it's uninhabitable and there's nothing there.
Is the guild a set that's not in the movies yet?
Actually. Yeah.
That's cool.
Because I actually just realized
that. I gotta read these sound cool.
I know. It's so good. But give yourself time. Like,
the political stuff is
a hard book.
Yes.
So, like, one of my fascinations with like literature like this is the political intrigue. It's part of why, like, if you watch the Star Wars prequels forgivingly, they can be pretty fun because the political stuff is quite interesting. It's just George Lucas, at that age in his filmmaking, isn't as talented as I think, like, the movies needed him to be, because like the political stuff is interesting. Part of like what's interesting with the first film, as like me and my wife were talking about it, like when we drive to go see a new movie, we're like, what do you think the movie's going to be about? And so we were talking about how like part of what's interesting with the first film is like there's this inference that the Emperor is afraid of the Atreides because of their power. But also the setup of the film with Chani's description is that the Harkonnens become so rich and powerful that she talks about how like the Harkonnens could probably defeat the Sardaukar. At least that's like her dialogue. So it's like he had to pit the two most powerful people to get against each other because his entire like if they teamed up they could kill him.
Oh, yes.
Especially if the family had learned that they had relation to the Harkonnens already anyway.
Yeah.
So Cheryl, there was a change that you said that was surprising, and then when you mentioned it, I had no idea about it. What was it?
I don't remember. What was it? What did I say?
Okay, so
it was the thing about the
I
thing.
Will reintroduce it. Okay, go ahead.
Was
go
it
ahead.
Who killed Harkonnen? Who killed Baron Harkonnen?
Okay, well, there was two, but also who kills Harkonnen?
His sister, Paul's sister, Elia, goes up and is like, "Hi, grandfather." Stabby, 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 stabby.
Oh, okay. So,
and
like,
she's like four.
She's like four. Okay, that's
so
cool.
That's one.
And then
the...
he goes floating off into a sandworm or something like that. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah, they
that's
do. They
so
go.
Cool.
He like he does get fed. So that is one of the biggest change. Like biggest. It's not the change I dislike the most. My biggest dislike is Chani's characterization is much different. Mm. But the biggest change that they did was that Jessica is still pregnant throughout this movie, and I think that works because then we didn't
I thought
get...
it was so cool. I love that was my favorite part of the movie.
It was great because we didn't get a Twilight Renesmee version of, I don't know if it's Aaliyah or Aaliyah. I don't know how it's pronounced, but of Paul's sister.
I know her as Aaliyah.
Aaliyah. That's fine. We'll go with Aaliyah.
Taylor Joy.
But, and Aaliyah, I love, yeah, right? I think Anya Taylor-Joy is a perfect casting, to be completely honest. Yeah, she's got just like the perfect, like, freaky, I drank the spicy magic water and changed my daughter into a mutant look. Like, it's perfect. Like, she's gorgeous. I love it. 100%. But it would have been weird to see her as like a little 5-year-old walking around with like adult speech everywhere. And like,
yeah,
what I did like about the book is like, it does creep everybody out. Like, everyone is weirded out by this child because of what she's saying, how she talks, how fast she's growing. Like, it's just weird. So I'm glad they didn't do that in the movie, because I think it would have taken away from things. So I think they did it fantastically.
It definitely fit the news vibe to have a movie where a pregnant woman can just have conversations with her child who's in the womb.
I just want to say, I wish that was possible, because you know how many problems that would do?
Right.
I've never been pregnant before, and I'm sure your wife, Jerry, could probably agree. I think it would be wonderful if we could talk to our unborn children.
And just like talk on the radio, like a Discord chat.
So but nice. It's
Liv, right? Liv would be so grateful if we can get in the heads of our kids while we were raising them, even. Like, what are they thinking? Like, right? That telepathic connection is just
teenagers,
would have been a god, especially between my wife and my daughter. Like, that's where.
Where is this water of life? We
yes.
need it.
And so there's that. I think what's really cool that, and of course, there's no way to explain this in a movie, is that the book, for quite a few of the books, so Dune Messiah, Children of Dune, really delve into this idea of genetic memory. And, you know, it's kind of that fringe science type of stuff. But the idea being that, like, you could tap into the memories of your parents up to the point where they conceived you, and then their parents and their parents and so on. And
is this, sorry to interrupt, I just want to clarify, is this because of the spice that they're able to do this, or is this just in general,
in
genetically
general,
people,
yeah,
they can do this? Oh, I thought it was the spice.
And the spice allows you to open that up. And the Bene Gesserit are the most equipped, okay, to pull it off, because
so
yeah,
they can do it without the spice.
Kind, yeah.
Right? And then...
Or the spice kind of enhances it, but they have that...
Is hands... Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
And so with the spice, the water of life, of course, it unlocks it not just in Jessica, it unlocks it in Aaliyah or Alia.
Worm pee.
Or Aaliyah.
Worm pee, yeah. That's the
They're
joke.
They're snorting, yes, worm poop. So yes. Worm pee, yeah, worm poop, it's everything.
That's the ultimate spoiler right there, right? Nobody realized that the spice is just worm excrement.
I watched a video talking about how do the worms move through the sand, and they were like, the most natural would be it eats the sand and then rejects it, which makes it move that way. And I was like, oh, that's, yeah, how they get spice then. That would make total sense. But
yeah.
Hey there, listener. Want to influence the podcast? Head on over to patreon.com/cinematicdoctrine and support the show for $3 a month. In doing so, you'll be able to vote on a movie poll that picks a film we discuss each month. So jump on over there and have your voice heard. Jerry, was there anything from the book that was changed or that you liked or didn't like or want to see in the future?
Yeah. And again, they did the change really well. Mm-hmm. You know, I mentioned the Gurney Halleck one, that he wasn't so much the grounding or the attempted grounding of the Atreides' values. But that time jump really kind of removes the longer transformation of Paul, mm-hmm, that from Paul Atreides to Muad'Dib, and he starts to think more and more like this person is about to go on a jihad, and that, you know, Gurney's the one who starts to recognize this, and they don't have that. It's just sort of like, okay, he's been learning their ways. There's the political play that Jessica is going through in the movie, mm-hmm, which you don't see as much in the book, I don't think, with Jessica. She's just kind of accepted her role as Reverend Mother. So to see that she's actively playing the Bene Gesserit role of, no, Paul is going to be Muad'Dib one way or another. Mm-hmm. He is the guy. And I'm going to see to it. And so that was, it works in the movie. It really works. Yeah. And, mm-hmm, and so I wasn't that disappointed by it. And before we recorded, I thought that there was a pivotal point in the book that gets Paul to say, that's it. I'm going all in here with the Messiah thing. Mm-hmm. And that was, so he would have an original son in the book that is killed by an attack from the Harkonnens and Sardaukar. And that I thought was the thing that sends him over the edge. At least the attack on his family was enough to say, okay, that's it. Gloves really come off now. Mm-hmm. Let's nuke these guys. But he doesn't find out his son actually died until the end of the battle. So there's that as well. But overall, yeah, it worked really well. And it's more of a change that I loved seeing. And that was at the end of the battle of Arakeen, when, the last of the palace Sardaukar go out to battle whoever's outside, and you hear the sword play, and it doesn't last very long.
And
then you see the silhouettes walking in, and Paul just walks up the steps right up to Baron Harkonnen and kills the guy. And I was like, yes, it's not the way it happened in the book, but I'm on board with that.
It just works so well.
Yes. And it played into the mythos of who is this Muad'Dib? Like, he is this guy we can't stop. And he just walked in, doesn't acknowledge the Emperor.
Yes.
Doesn't acknowledge Fade Ralta.
It was great.
The remainder of anybody, he acknowledges none of them. They don't matter because he can see everything. And he just sees, boom, there's the guy who killed my father.
He knows he's going to get to them.
Yeah.
They're fine.
Yeah.
We're going to you first. Got to get you out of the way.
And
he knows what's coming.
It's like he didn't say, like, I'm Paul Atreides, you killed my father, prepare to die either. That would have been. But he essentially said, hello, grandfather. And
exactly.
Nobody in his past lineage has watched Princess Bride. So that's why he couldn't call it.
Right?
He could have gotten away with it. He's the creator of it, obviously.
That scene was dope. That was
cool. Yeah. There was. At the very end of the fight between Fade and Paul, I almost got mad. And,
ooh, what was it?
It was just the way.
Curious too.
Yeah. So, because the whole thing about parts one and two was Paul exploring all these different paths that are possible in time. So, like in the battle for Arakeen at the end of part two, it turns out the visions that we saw of Paul leaping over people and killing Sardaukar, and then his visor comes up and it's him. Well, when we see the actual battle unfold, apparently in this timeline, it's not him. It's Chani who is wiping out Sardaukar left and right, and it's her with the pose. I'm like, oh, that's so cool. Mm-hmm. So he's fighting Fade Ralta, and I don't think it's in the book, but then like at some point, Paul's got a knife sticking out of him and Fade put it there. I'm like, what? Okay, it's fine. It's cool. But then Fade goes in for the kill. And, you know, like Paul is barely holding onto that knife and it's going in. I'm like, I was about to scream, what the heck is going on? I was about to throw down my popcorn.
Is this the timeline they're choosing?
Yes. And I'm like, no, this is not okay. Like, this is in my head. I'm about to scream. This is not okay. No, this is a change I'm not okay with.
It'd be huge. Yeah.
This
is,
and,
it would be.
And then when it's over, I'm like, oh, thank God.
Close call.
And I love that the way that fight actually ended was how we got a preview of it when Gurney and Paul did their practice fight on Caladan in part one. And I was like, I love that.
I'm going to have to watch that
and
again.
It's that. And he also has the vision of being stabbed. Like, and it's some, so like there's this, and what I liked most about the first one, especially on reflection with the second, is the first one being about possibility. Like that was something in our Dune episode that I talked about, was like, to me, the first one is so like the one, the first one's really spiritual as opposed to this one, which is more adventuring. And so I'm hoping the third one becomes more of a combination of the two. And it sounds like from what you guys shared is sort of the tone of Messiah. Of Dune Messiah, that's going to be the case. But the first one, like when he's at the end and he's fighting Jamis, and you get this like verbal monologue, semi-poetry prose thing of like, when you take a life, you also lose your own. And it's like, to me, I interpret it as this, like, it's this beautiful thing about like the inherent value of life, to which like, if you reject someone, if you hate somebody, you are killing possibility and the possibility for goodness, for opportunity. And like, what's cool in this fiction is that Paul can still kind of participate in it. I've seen really interesting conversation about the literature saying like the reason Jamis is so important, and the reason in the second movie he's like talking to Jamis still, is because like in another line, of possibility. Jamis is the one who trains him, not what's his name?
Stilgar.
And so like he's taking benefit from all these other lives he could have lived. And it's not just that they're things he could learn, but like it seems like him and Jamis have like a genuine passion and relationship between one another, as opposed to this timeline where it's like Stilgar just is like what's the line, Lisa Hagaib, like he just loves him, but it's not really him.
Yeah.
it's this thing. And so like I thought that yeah. was just so almost like life affirming about the value of social relationship and so beautiful with the first film as opposed to the second one. So like, although I don't have anything book related to talk about differences, I do like think in terms of the two films as different units, that first movie being more about that to me was much more compelling, at least than the second one. Although the second one is like a perfect film, so it's like it's compelling in its own right and has a lot more to chew on. But Cheryl, you had a thought.
So it kind of connects to two different things that I like what they did with the movie and what they didn't do with the movie. So first, Jamis has a wife, and in Fremen culture you like get the spouse, whether it's a wife or not. Like, I don't know if there's like actual marriages everything. That happen in the Fremen, like you get everything of that, including whoever their partner is. So Paul technically has a instant wife, but he's very honorable. That's right. He has like two extra kids, but he's very respectful and honoring to Chani. And he's like, I'm not like, we're not actually going to be partners. And there's like a thing, like if nothing happens between them, like physically for a year, Jamis's wife is like free to go, essentially. So in that way, Chani doesn't care that Paul decides to marry the princess as a political move. Chani's like, that's fine. That's a normal thing. Like in that, like she would have been kind of used to that because of the kind of culture she grew up in. So that's why she doesn't really care.
In
like
the
she
literature.
Obviously feels something.
Yeah.
Like she's upset, but like she understands that it's for political reasons. So they obviously didn't do that in the book. So Jamis didn't have a wife. There's even a whole scene where they're like taking like objects of his, and Paul takes this musical instrument
and he takes
it because Gurney plays it. And I'm like, oh, they didn't do that. Would have been fun. Like, so it was kind of random that Gurney was like playing this like weird guitar thing, but it meant something in the book.
Yes.
But, and I forget where I was going to tie this in.
No, you committed the podcast sin.
I did. I know, but it had to do with Stilgar and like the friendship of Stilgar. And like, so, and like between him and Jamis, and I, if it's okay for me to read a section of
course.
The book that I think they did really well in the movie, and now of course it's being memed up the wazoo of Stilgar being like,
Lisa Hagaib.
He's Lisa Hagaib. Like he would of course deny that he is the Messiah. He's the Messiah. Like it's a whole like Monty Python kind of thing, and like this, the acting is just so good because Chalamet really evokes this loneliness that he ends up having. Like if you really look at the movie and then in the book. He has no one. He has no friends. Like, he has Chani.
He doesn't have any authentic relationships.
Who, in the book, is very much like, I love you. Yeah, and, like, Jessica is like, you're going to be the Messiah.
Right.
You're going to do this. Yes. And then in the movie, Chani is like, dude, I love you, but, like, stop. Like, you can't do this.
Leto like, was the only one who loved him, like, as him.
Exactly.
And it didn't matter who he was going to be. Leto is like, I'm still going to love and care for you. And then he's gone.
Yeah.
And now he literally has nobody. So he's got Arrested Development. He just doesn't know how to react to Chani being like, nah. Like, he literally, he's still underdeveloped. Killing people. Crazy.
What I love how they did this in the movie, like, they obviously... So, one thing about the book is that it's written from, like, third-person God view, so you get everybody's inner monologue.
Cool.
Like, from paragraph to... Cool is not the word I would use. I was very irritated by it. It took me a very long time to get used to it. And that's why it took me
What
so
is
long
your preferred
book.
Prose? I know you're about to read that, but like what do you typically prefer?
Not God view. I don't want to know if I don't mind like if every chapter is a different character and I'm hearing the inner monologue, but from paragraph to paragraph, like I hear Jessica and then Paul and I'm like, I don't know what's going on. This is very confusing. So it took a while to get used to it.
Explains the length of the book. Okay. Been itching for Cinematic Doctrine merch? Check out the support tiers on Patreon. We're offering merch to those who support at select tiers. So head on over to patreon.com/cinematicdoctrine and share your support. There's a link in the show notes too.
But we get a little bit of that here. So it's just a quick little section that kind of explains how Paul is feeling. So this is right before, I think this is right when they've gotten to Arakeen. They may have already kind of defeated and they're about to see the Emperor. Chani and Jessica show up. This is where Chani tells Paul that his son is dead. It's like, I think just before or just after. So Paul says to Stilgar and some of his men, "My mother's sick with longing for a planet she may never see," Paul said, "where water falls from the sky and plants grow so thickly you cannot walk between them." "Water from the sky," Stilgar whispered. In that instant, and this is what I like, in that instant, Paul saw how Stilgar had been transformed from the Fremen Naib to a creature of the Lysan Al Gaib, a receptacle of for awe and obedience. It was a lessening of the man, and Paul felt the ghost wind of the jihad in it. "I have seen a friend become a worshiper," he thought. In a rush of loneliness, Paul glanced around the room, noting how proper and on review his guards had become in his presence. He sensed the subtle, prideful competition among them, each hoping for notice from Muad'Dib. "Muad'Dib, from whom all blessings flow," he thought, and it was the bitterest thought of his life. "They sense that I must take the throne," he thought, "but they cannot know I do it to prevent the jihad." And I just, like, that is so sad.
And that's good stuff.
Like,
yeah.
It's just, like, throughout the book, Paul is just lonely. Like, he doesn't want the jihad. He thinks that taking the throne is going to prevent the jihad. Spoiler alert, it doesn't. And that's, I mean, yeah, the end of this, the end,
the
of
end
part
of the movies, like,
all right,
Holy War starts. Yeah.
Like, there's literally no way around it. And, but he doesn't want it. But, like, Stilgar, and you get a little bit more of a relationship between Stilgar and Paul in the book, but they do become friends. But as soon as Paul starts going down the path of Muad'Dib, everything changes for him. And, like, that's really sad that, like, he just wanted to be a kid. He was just the son of a duke. And then he finds out that his mom, like, purposely made him in her womb to give Duke Leto an heir, but also to try to maybe turn him into the Bene Gesserit Messiah for the Fremen.
Well, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It's just so sad. And I think the acting and the directing of the movie pulled that off perfectly. Like, it, chef's kiss. Love it.
Yeah, you figure he's trying to figure out, how do I combat my own wants and desires for revenge? Because that's one of his big motivations, at least specifically in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But also friendship, because he does need people to be with. And, like, part of his longing and the desires of the first film, like the Jamis visions and stuff, is for relationship. And then also not cause the end of a galactic war and stuff. It's definitely compelling. Talking about, like, this idea of, like, seeing somebody turn into a worshiper as opposed to a friend, it's interesting thinking, like, biblically, like, how the disciples treat Jesus. Because what often happens is there's Jesus, who he actually is, God. So God, literal God. And then there is who we envision Jesus is. And oftentimes we still envision him incorrectly, similar to how we envision each other incorrectly. And in relationship, we grow closer to one another and become more understanding of one another. And we persevere in that. And the way the disciples treat Jesus often is the Messiah they yearned for him to be, up to and including Jesus's arrest, because Peter, you know, almost goes to kill somebody. And Jesus is like, "Look, if I wanted angels to come fight for me and I wanted to take everything, that way I could just do it. I don't need you. But that's not what I'm here for." And Jesus, of course, is here to take away our sins, to show love in that way through his death on the cross. If you do not know him, go and repent to him in your heart. Do so. There's nothing like it. But this dynamic of Jesus constantly saying who he is and who he wants to be because of who he is, who he wants to be to his disciples, and then contrasted against who the disciples are trying to figure out who he is. That's just an interesting kind of image, similarly to that, of like looking on and having a sadness for that, which is such an interesting way to show that. And changes even how, like, when you finish out the book of John, it's like just friends getting together as after Jesus is resurrected, and they're just fishing and have a fire for breakfast. Mm-hmm. And it's just like this friendly moment of Jesus being to Peter, like, do you love me? And like, Peter's like, yes, asked three times. And then, all that to say is like seeing, I also thought of, it's like an inverse, this film of the Christ story, obviously. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very pointedly like a militant savior who, for his own purposes, is taking advantage of this worshiping group to the point that, like, I don't watch Paul going into that room, right? And he starts spouting prophecy at these people and their dreams back at them to convince mm-hmm. them he's the Messiah. And, like, you're like, part of you could react and say, like, that doesn't seem like his character. But in terms of his motivations, it's almost like he's doing it bitterly, like frustratingly. Like, I just need to kill the Baron.
He doesn't want this.
Yeah.
Like, the whole book is that. Like, Paul.
In the first movie, he doesn't
want this. He's like, he doesn't want it at all. Yeah. Even as it continues and, like, he leads essentially the jihad and all this killing, he never wants it. It's just what's happening around and to him, and like the outside forces, the Bene Gesserit, essentially creating
the real everything villains, that's happening. Honestly,
they're talking to the Fremen, and then the Fremen are like worshiping him, and he's like, I don't know what to do. Like, he has no agency over his own life, and like the beginning part of the second book kind of talks about a little bit of that. And it's like super, it's just really sad. It's so sad. I feel so bad for Paul.
And I didn't think about this until just hearing you both talk about this, that even if the events of Arrakis never happened, you know, that the emperor doesn't get freaked out about the Atreides, doesn't send them into Arrakis in place of the Harkonnens, and then sets up this whole, you know, annihilation. Mm-hmm. Paul really never had agency over his life, because when he was born, you know, mom's raising him to be a Bene Gesserit, you know, to use those powers.
Yeah.
That already was not normal, because that's something that was passed from female to female, mother to daughter, you know, whatever that is. The Mentat would not teach the Mentat computational ways of doing analytics to a non-Mentat. Like, they've got a whole academy they send you through, and here's the Mentat of the family who's now with, you know, working on the third generation of Atreides that he's serving. Thufir Hawat is teaching Paul how to do analytics like a Mentat. And then you've got the Master of Arms and the Sword Master both teaching Paul tactics, strategy, sword fighting, weapons of all kinds. And then, you know, the dad, Leto, is teaching Paul, this is how you lead people. This is how you build loyalty and all that, because you're going to take over. And so Paul never really, like, his own destiny, his only option was, you're going to lead people and you're going to need these tools to do it. And there is no other option. People are going to try to kill you just because you got born into this. And so the art of Canley, and we're going to try to, you know, it's Game of Thrones, but in space,
basically
decades before Game of Thrones ever came out. And I was just like, wow, Paul did not stand a chance. Like, he was going to have to fight and lead and be these things, maybe on a smaller scale, but because of what we see in Dune Part 1 and 2, he winds up fulfilling all those prophecies that, you know, the Bene Gesserit really started, all because they wanted to break up the monopoly that the guild had with the spice trade. That's really what this all boiled down to, is that, you know, the Bene Gesserit are going all Griselda. It's like, hey, why are these guys the only ones who get to deal with the drug of space? You know, let's cut into that. And the Kwisatz Haderach was supposed to kind of break through that. Like, not only can I do what the guild does, I don't even need their spice to do it. Like, that's the whole thing they're trying to create. But they're also, like, the Bene Gesserit are pretty awesome in the sense of, like, because my daughter's boyfriend was asking when we watched part one together recently, they wanted to watch part two, and I went without them. I'm so sorry, Ryan, Emma, I love you guys. We will go again. I promise.
See you again.
Yes, I will go see it again. And we'll even bring your brother, Emma, because he's also heard I went without him. So the Bene Gesserit are a really amazing group of people in that. So the Mentats they focused on math in terms of computating, you know, everything from accounting to predictions of like behavior of people. So analytics kind of thing. The Space Guild did the same thing, but they took that math and those calculations using the SPICE to predict where they could bend and fold space and do space travel very quickly and very fast through their highliners. And then the Bene Gesserit also looked at humanity in terms of we can control every cell in our bodies down to the DNA level, so much so, or the chromosomal level, so much so that it's no longer the male in our species who could determine the sex of a child. We could do it ourselves, and all we need is a donation. And so they were asking me, like, why is it that the whole thing with the voice is so powerful? And this is probably the one thing I wish would have been portrayed, but it also probably would have dragged the movie out a bit. And this goes back to when everybody was starting to suspect that Jessica was the spy. And this is more from the book because it's not really shown in the movies. There's a scene in the book where Thufir Hawat confronts Jessica. It's just the two of them in a room. And Thufir is like trying to basically tell her, hey, fess up and just turn yourself in kind of thing. And instead she uses the voice on him and he freezes. And then she like closes in with a knife and he realizes I can't do anything to stop her. And I didn't see this coming. And what the heck? Why can't I move? Like he's freaking out in his head and he realizes this is something they can do and none of us know about it. So that whole thing with the voice and being able to control people, like that's almost like a secret. Like the rest of the universe has no clue this happens. And when it's all said and done, Jessica like kind of tells them, hey, and this is just our secret, because if you let this out, I'll make sure you die and it'll look like you did it to yourself. Kind of thing. Like, I was like, dang.
She's a scary character.
Yeah.
She's like one of the coolest characters.
She's so good.
Is an excellent like choice for her. She does it so well.
It says really so much about the power of fear and leveraging that in this universe they're in, because it's that where Thufir Hawat realizes she can't be the spy because she could just get Duke Leto to kill himself.
Yeah. And why would she take all this other stuff when she could just do it? Yeah.
Yes. And
it's interesting. So
it's very powerful in that respect.
The movie doesn't, it obviously makes the voice like extremely powerful, like up to the point that like when Paul uses it on the Bene Gesserit at the end of two, it's like shocking. And it's like, you feel it with her where she's like, I cannot believe his voice is attuned enough to do that.
Did you see Fade's reaction to that?
I didn't. Does he like freak out or?
No, because they kind of decided that his character would be very, he likes violence. So his reaction was like,
Oh, this is interesting.
He's masochistic. Yeah. So he's like, and I was surprised that Paul didn't use it, because I'm curious if like that would be to him considered dishonorable, but like,
probably,
man, use whatever you want, but maybe the rules of that engagement is blades only, but it would be cool if the movies had sort of set up at the very least that the voice was secret. I had no idea that's a particularly cool detail.
I wonder, because the sister uses it a lot, and I wonder if that's going to come out a little bit more in Messiah when she's born, because like she's a powerful little thing.
She just decides I'm going to use it a lot.
She'll use. There's like a scene, I think it's in the first book. They obviously don't have it in the movie. Is it the first one? There's a scene where she interacts with the Reverend Mother Bene Gesserit. And then also Baron Harkonnen. Like there's a whole thing. And it's like, they're all freaked out by that. And not just because she's a 3-year-old talking like a 30-year-old, but because she has this power.
That's awesome. That's so cool. Want some quick updates on the podcast? Follow the Cinematic Doctrine Instagram for cool posts and story updates. Press the link in the show notes or search Cinematic Doctrine, that's one word, in your Instagram app. Oh, and we're on Threads. Check us out there too. But transitioning into the end, just so we can kind of transition to what we think is going to happen next. Obviously, the two of you have read a bit of that. But in terms of the movies, maybe the tones or direction, because they've been different. So the thing that I was prompting, and we didn't get into, but I'll prompt again. You had said that Chani's character is very different, Cheryl, from the book. That in the book, Tim Tam and Zendaya would be hooking up, and they'd have kids, and one of the kids ended up dying.
Yeah.
And that her character is less, let's call it, I'd say like less animated, it sounds like. She's much more determined in the book, much more militant. And then by the end of this movie, which would timeline-wise would be matching up with the book, so the end of the book, and then the movie ends basically on, it's Chani's ending. Like, Chani is determined as if to say, like, I reject Paul. I reject what Paul is doing. I'm not in support of it. I do not respect him, and I'm leaving. And perhaps setting up that she'll be her own faction, her own people. And
if
perhaps
when they do that, I will be very disappointed.
Well, don't do it, guys.
If they go that
independence, right?
But even
like
then,
narratively, as a trilogy, it could be Chani becomes the thing that brings him back to clarity. Because it sounds like you're saying maybe the books, but like,
see, I don't know.
Well, I'm just saying, like, that's how this movie ends. She is determined, separate, off to meet her own horizon, separate from Paul.
Okay, this is how they could do it. This is how they could bring it back to match it with the book, despite moving it that way. So we were talking that the very last line of the book, if I can get to it quickly.
I had it bookmarked, and then I was playing with the bookmark, so
yeah,
I don't have it bookmarked anymore.
Wow, there's a lot
of I had fun playing with my bookmark.
There's a scene, so in the movie, Chani is very upset that Paul is like, yo, I'm going to marry the princess. Like, I'm going to love you forever. This is a political move. I'm going to marry the princess. So in the book, she's...
Which, yeah, he decided to do in the first movie anyway, because...
Yeah, and that was part of the plan. Like, he knew what he was doing. It wasn't like a spur of the moment kind of thing. So this happens. I don't think he gives her too much warning in the book. He like turns to her and goes, I love you. Emperor, I'm going to marry your daughter. Like, it's within seconds. And like, Chani's like, wait, what? And Jessica, having been the concubine of Duke Leto, they never married, says to Chani, think on it, Chani. That princess will have the name, yet she will live as less than a concubine, never to know a moment of tenderness from the man to whom she's bound. While we, Chani, we who carry the name of concubine, history will call us wives. And so, and that's how the book ends, which I think is great. Ended on a woman's voice. And Jessica's, of all people, too. If in the beginning of Messiah, so the second movie, third movie, however we want to call it.
Sure.
If Jessica has this conversation with Chani, then I think Chani will be like, okay, I'm still not happy, but I get it. And then she'll be like, all right, Paul, I support you. Let's do this. We're going to be work side by side. I don't like that you have to do this. Because then there are very sad things that happen between the throuple, kind of. It's not really a throuple because they're not.
Yeah, they're not
polyamorous,
all together.
But the three of them, there are things that happen that like one does to the other. And it's very depressing.
The political dynamic.
That has to happen. Yeah. So I feel like that's the only way they can kind of bring it back to get Chani on Paul's side, because that's how it happens in the book. And that's how things have to happen in the book with the way things open in Dune Messiah. Like, it can't be anything different. So if they drastically change her character to be like, I'm going to start my own faction and go against Paul, and we're going to fight.
Yeah, I don't mean faction like she's going to have her own group like the Marvel movies. But all that to say is she has her own determination and pursuits.
Yeah.
But Jared,
yeah.
what do you think? Like, what do you think of the ending? And then what do you think's coming next?
I did like how it ended. I think I shared earlier the moment I almost lost it.
And yes.
They brought that back. I was like, oh, thank you.
They just killed Paul.
He's like, God, what is this? Kind of like it was like flashbacks to Twilight, that wonderful Twilight Part 2. And
oh, I hated that.
Yeah, I was feeling that kind of anger in that moment. But I was also looking at that last page when you were reading that passage that Jessica says to Chani, and the paragraph before that, when Paul is reassuring Chani, hey, she's just going to have my name. She's not going to have a baby. She's not going to have my love. It's going to be us. And you don't even need a title for that. And Chani actually says, you say that now, or so you say now.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, there was a little bit of, you know, doubt and concern. And I think Denis Villeneuve capitalized on that to make it look like they broke
up.
Make it
dramatic.
Yeah. Like, she is like, nope, he's gone a different route. And then he's taken his jihad into space to take out the Lanzrad and whatever else happens. Pretend like I don't know. I liked how they ended it. I love that they ended it with these guys are jumping on their now fleet. They now have a fleet of spaceships. They didn't have that really before. Yeah. And they've definitely got the spice to pay the guild to take them wherever they want, because they have the monopoly on that. And so big warning about the power of monopoly and how we really don't want that either from a capitalism kind of thing. But I kind of see them going one of two ways with the third movie. I think I've read that Denis Villeneuve really wanted to have a trilogy of some kind, and somehow this is going into Dune Messiah. So, and I think that's a realistic jump to go into, because you can kind of cap off that. And I don't want to give away spoilers there, but the jump from book one to book two is about 10 years. So, and we're kind of at the tail end of this jihad at the end of when the second book starts. So either A, they're going to do this time jump as well and get us up to speed politically what's going on, and then because I know there's going to have to be some action here, and I don't know if they're going to stay true to the book itself or if they're going to add like some flashbacks of, you know, this is us taking Caladan, which we really didn't have to because they were still on our side, and this is us wiping and taking these guys on, and the remnants of the Sardaukar, or, you know, like the one garrison that got left behind. It's like, what? Hey, what's up? Where's everybody?
Yeah.
Who are you guys? and so it'd be interesting to see if they pick up where the end of movie number two ended, and do they kind of just bring us right into the jihad and spend a lot of time there and transition. So is it going to be more of that time crunch, or are we going to have that time jump and stay true to the source material? So I'd like to see them stay more to the source material. They gave us the glimpse of Alia.
yes.
Yeah, so we got a glimpse of her as an adult, or at least a very old teenager. So I think they'll do a time jump, I think. So
And they could do almost like Paul is having nightmare visions of the jihad prior, and then not even just like flashbacks of like, let me tell you about what happened and then the exposition, but like, because it would make sense for him having like the dreams about things, because he's at this point very conflicted about stuff. So I agree. I think a time jump would make the most sense.
Jerry, does the end of the book end with so in the movie this battle's happening with the Emperor, Baron Harkonnen, before the Emperor shows up, is like, he's gonna show up and kill us, so we need to call everybody. So then they call everybody, all the houses are at Arrakis in orbit, and then Baron Harkonnen's killed, the Emperor loses his empire. And then the last line in the movie is like, the other houses reject your claim to the Emperor, Paul Atreides or whatever. Does the book end that way? Like, all of the other houses are in orbit and that immediately close?
I think they were just stunned.
I think it's the guild that's actually in orbit. And Paul calls them. Paul calls the guild ahead of time.
And
if I
like,
recall correctly,
I'm going to take the
I think
Empire,
Paul so. Calls the guild ahead of time, because Paul's like, well, I got the spice. I got the Fremen, therefore I have the spice, so I can control the guild and like, stuff like that. So it's the guild power that's up there.
I think he has the Lanzrad there as witnesses. So I think they do show up as witnesses.
Okay.
Just curious, because to me, then that implies, like, I suspect the next movie would probably either do a combination of time jump, or it could just be as quick as part one and two were, like, just, all right, we're not starting this war now, but it's like, we're mobilizing because now the houses are against us. Because I don't know what's next. I don't know if he goes to war with the other houses. I don't know how big the politics get. I know there's a bunch of people that were cast in this movie that didn't end up in the final cut. So I'm sure they were in different houses that with different leaders. But I presume that the next direction, so like I said, I think at the start, like the first movie is Dreams Are Messages from the Deep. This movie opens with the line, something like, spice is power, whoever has the spice has the power, that kind of thing. And that's what this movie kind of is like this growth in power and getting essentially drunk on power for Paul. And then the final line, one of the final lines in the scene is the emperor essentially saying, why did the events of these movies happen? Which is like Duke Leto ran and led by the heart, and the heart is not meant to lead. And I suspect that's a narrative allusion to what is to come next, which is Paul discerning between essentially what this movie romantically was, is like, okay, the romantic line and setup is Paul and Chani, but then the end is Paul and Florence Pugh. So that's the mind as opposed to the heart, which the heart seemed to be towards Chani. So I suspect that romance will continue with the politics and the leadership of the, into the third film, which will then be a probably exploration of like what's going to be leading. Because if you've, as you two have alluded, the following book kind of goes into Paul's response to the events of this film, meditation on whether he thinks it was good or bad or whatever it's going to be. That's sort of where I suspect this next movie will go, with a combination of, I said to Catherine, I hope there's planet hopping. Cause I really like, I love how in this movie, all these locations feel very distinct, and raw. But I also have always felt like, unlike Earth, which has different biomes, the planets, even in our solar system, are very singular. And so it would be nice for us to get some planet hopping and jumping around. Maybe some space based combat could be pretty fun to see how Villeneuve does that. Cause I don't think he's done something like that yet. He hasn't, he's always been planet side. So yeah, that's what I'm suspecting. That's what I hope. Again, haven't read the books, don't know where we're going. I just know that the stories go on for a very long time. So so there's a wealth of content here, but definitely happy to have a new story to keep up with, because this stuff has been really cool. So any final thoughts from either of you guys for this? Let's start with Jerry. Any final thoughts on Dune?
Go see it, folks, if you haven't seen it already. And
gosh, yes.
If you really want to get in depth, I don't know if you want to read the books first and then go see it. But if you're somebody who like has to see it literally portrayed, read the books after. But the books really give you a lot of depth into what the heck. I've seen a lot of TikTok movie or videos that talk about, what did I watch and what is all this? But when you read the books, at least the first book, you're like, oh, that's happening. Oh, that's happening. Oh, they showed that.
That's cool. And then what about you, Cheryl? Any final thoughts?
100% agree. Go see it. From, even though I am a huge reader, I had a lot of difficulty reading this book. And I did find it helpful to see the movie first so that I could have like faces to names, all that kind of stuff. And then that's it fun. Did help, yeah, I like a lot too. Of the inner monologues of all the characters from paragraph to paragraph, from line to line, just like jumping from different people, how Villeneuve was able to convey all that without actually giving us like voiceover, like the David Lynch films. Cause that was his answer to the inner monologues, was just to have voiceover of the characters' thoughts. And I'm glad they didn't do that, because I feel like it's a lot of show don't tell is what they really need to do. And that's, I think, to the detriment of the book. However, the book definitely expands on everything, and like, just, it's the meat. Like, you might, it's like the 12 course meal versus the 6 course meal kind of thing. I don't know if that's a great metaphor comparison, well, meat was but good. Like, the book is meatier, yes.
Some meat has fat, but it gives it flavor.
That's there you go. See, you and my husband are very good at metaphors and stuff like that. I need to learn how to do that, because yes, like, the book does that, adds all that extra flavor and the meatiness of what's going on. And then the movie just kind of helps give you the visualization to it. So if you want to read the book, watch the movie, read the book, because it'll help.
Yeah, I definitely obviously recommend it, and recommend it even in the in-depth way that we kind of explored it. There's so much like in theory we haven't even covered. And yet also like there's a sufficiency to it, because it's just something I think that the movie, when I first saw it, great. And then when I'm sitting on it, it's gotten better and better and better. And it's just good. And it's convinced me to be like more involved. Like I want to check out, like I said, the classic movie and then the BBC miniseries. Reading it could be pretty cool too. There's just a lot of really cool stuff to be explored with Dune. So yeah, definitely good. Really, really enjoyed it. Best of the year. This or Madam Web. This is the best of the year. But you may not know this, but the easiest way you can show your support for Cinematic Doctrine is to rate and review the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen. So press pause and share your thoughts. We'd love to hear what you have to say. And then press play again so you can hear the rest of the show. Well, transitioning into recommendations, we'll go Cheryl, then we'll go Jerry, and then we'll go me. So Cheryl, what recommendation do you have?
That's a great question.
Should we switch the rotation?
I'm trying to think of things that I haven't recommended before.
All right, I'll recommend.
You should go. I'm going to go last so I can.
And then Jerry will go middle.
Yeah.
I'm going to recommend a movie I just watched last night. As I've been saying to every episode for the last couple months, I've been watching either East Asian horror or found footage movies because I've just been. I've never gotten into East Asian horror, which now it doesn't make sense because I've been watching it since last summer. And then found footage is a cozy thing for me. I rewatched Paranormal Activity 1, which when I was a kid petrified me, but this time bored me. I was just so bored of it. When I was a kid, I covered my face, didn't even see the ending, but this time it was just like, it was interesting and mumblecore-y and kind of fascinating because it's so simple and empty and boring. But whatever. But then I'd never seen the second one or any of the other movies. So I watched the second one last night and I thought it was way better. I thought it was way more interesting. There was way more event. I like that these movies don't necessarily have a metaphor to them, but you can read into them if you want. Like the first one is kind of interesting because like it's, as I wrote in my Letterboxd review, just standard layman jumping to the fact they're just immediately going, oh, it's demons. Like, you want to check those door hinges first? Like, you want to make sure everything's okay? Because it could just be the door hit. And so I just found that kind of interesting. But Paranormal Activity 2, I really appreciated the film having a lot more event, more narrative, more story. And then also just the scenes were more freaky. And so if you just, and also it was cozy, it's quiet. I found myself being both stupendously comfortable laying on the couch while also being incredibly engaged. And not many movies do that. It's sort of weird. I don't know how else to describe it, but had a very good sense of spatial fear and awareness and had some pretty frightening scenes. Check out Paranormal Activity 2 if you're kind of in an interest, as I have been, for very odd particular films like that. Because, yeah, that's what I recommend. So just watch links in the show notes, as always. Jerry, what do you recommend our listeners?
Besides Dune 2, I just started watching Silo on Apple TV.
Oh, I hear that's good.
And it is good. Everything from the world building, the details of the silo itself, the culture of that, and the mystery to it too. And so I'm still curious, like, how did they, without giving away too much, but the idea being, you got these folks, they've lived in a silo underground. It has everything they need to survive underground, as long as everybody does their part and that they maintain this homeostasis of their culture. Mm-hmm. It's 10,000 people, 144 levels. It's so big that it takes at least a day to go from the top level down to the bottom one.
Cardio. Jeez.
Yes. Yes. And I'm four episodes into it right now, and it's now getting into the political play and how delicate that balance really was. And then the whole question driving the whole thing is, what really is outside? Is it safe? Is it the toxic wasteland that we're being shown? And what's going on? How did we get here? Why is it we celebrate this Freedom Day? And why did we erase our databases 140 years ago? So it's like they're kind of just there. So it's really neat. Very intriguing.
That's Apple Plus, right?
Yes.
Man, or whatever they call it. Jeez, I feel like they've changed the name like three times. I've heard that like their curation for their originals is like top notch. Every year I hear like two or three shows, and they only come out, I feel like, with like five a year. Like two or three shows are like, you got to watch this. Like every time. It's crazy. And then Cheryl, what do you got?
I finally thought of something.
Time's up.
My husband's bookshelf behind me. And I was like, you know what? I don't know if I've recommended this before on the podcast, but I'm going to recommend the Stormlight Archives series by Brandon Sanderson. If you like fantasy, if you want epic world building, cool magic systems, and then also follow a character who just like constantly is depressed and trying to figure out why, even though it's a lot of his own decision making. It sounds bad, but it's actually quite good. It's a really good adventure series. It's my husband's favorite. I finally ended up listening to the audiobook because, much like Dune, these books are thick. They're huge. Like, you could build a house out of these books. They're just so big. Like, it's 50 hour plus.
Yeah. Yes.
50 hour plus audiobooks. So I recommend the audiobooks. The narrators are fantastic, but I wanted to look up someone else's better idea of why you should read it. And it, definite, like, the classic theme of battle between good and evil, but in like a slightly modern way. It's very hopeful, even though by the end you're like, what the heck is going on? It's known as the Sanderlanch, because everything is kind of going fine and then everything just gets totally destroyed by the end and you're left like, excuse me?
Okay.
And then you have to read the second book, which doesn't explain anything from the first book, because it's just this constant like from point A to point B, and it's everything in between. It's almost hard to describe, but it is so much fun and sad to go through. And I haven't finished it. I have one more
but
to catch
good.
Up to what he's got, but fantastic. And he's just a really cool guy. He writes ridiculously. Like, George R.R. Martin better be jealous of Brandon Sanderson, because during quarantine, Sanderson wrote 5 books.
Oh, George R.R. Martin's jealous of everybody who writes more than a page a day.
Yeah.
There's like a notorious conversation he had with like Stephen King, and he's like, how do you freaking do it? Like,
right?
Keep writing books. Oh, man.
Maybe take notes from other writers.
Links will definitely be in the show notes for all those. Jerry, thanks so much for making a lot of time for this episode. I feel like we ran a little longer than I was expecting, but it's Dune, so I
it
feel like
worth
that's
it.
All right. So,
yes.
let people know where they can get connected with you.
Yeah, my podcast is Beyond the Rut. You can get it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, I guess on YouTube now, and then my website, beyondtherut.com. And the book, Beyond the Rut, is also on Amazon, as well as Barnes and Noble, and wherever you get your favorite ebooks. And so that's Beyond the Rut, Create a Life Worth Living in Your Faith, Family, and Career.
Thanks so much for checking out this episode of Cinematic Doctrine. If you enjoyed this episode, consider leaving a review and subscribing to the podcast. And as mentioned before, Cinematic Doctrine has a Patreon. For as little as $3 a month, you're opted into a once-a-month movie poll where you decide a movie we discuss on the podcast. There are other unique benefits that come with supporting the podcast, so be sure to check that out at patreon.com/cinematicdoctrine. A special shout out to those who support at the Art House Theater tier on Patreon. Thank you so much, Mom, Dad, Melanie, Sherlion, and Thomas. You guys are the best, and your continued monetary support is greatly appreciated. Until next time, stay cool. Want some Cinematic Doctrine swag? You're in luck. We've got 3-inch Cinematic Doctrine logo stickers exclusive for Patreon supporters. Perfect for your travel mug or laptop. Head over to patreon.com/cinematicdoctrine, link in the show notes, and choose the independent theater tier. Doing so will net you other perks too. But let's be real, the podcast stickers are the coolest perk. So get yourself some podcast stickers by supporting on Patreon.